Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning into the conversation on this Aloha Friday, February 13th, Hawaii Talks. At this hour, State Attorney General Ann Lopez is holding a news conference to address issues that are swirling around a probe tied to an influential lawmaker and $35,000 in a paper bag. We'll get the latest before the end of our show. And a $10 million federal grant will help bolster Hawaii's healthcare future. We hear how Hawaii Pacific University is planning to help medical students tackle the overbearing debt. We mark Hawaiian Language Month by highlighting our Hawaiian immersion schools, and we stop by a sixth grade classroom on Molokai where Olelo Hawaii Hawaiian language thrives. Plus, he had her at Chow Bella. We meet a James Beard nominated chef and his wife. They had to rebuild their popular Lahaina restaurant after the wildfires. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii's healthcare crisis, with a shortage of workers from doctors to nurses and more, got a shot in the arm with the announcement of $10 million to help with boosting our workforce in rural areas. Jennifer Walsh is the Senior Vice President of Strategic Initiative and Chief Strategy Officer for Hawaii Pacific University. She talked with us about what this means for students who can apply for grants to help ease the tuition burden over the next 5 years.
We're very excited to partner with the state of Hawaii to address this ongoing community need. I have served at the governor's request on a steering committee for the last couple of years, wherein we evaluate student loan forgiveness applications for funds that the state has made available. And those are primarily to hopefully attract and retain practitioners. And there has been a preference to support neighboring island rural communities who have the worst of the shortage problem. But this is the first time we've been able to secure full tuition grants to really incentivize students to stay in Hawaii for their education, and then beyond that, stay in the state to practice, at least for the first 5 years. And hopefully they'll be established and grounded and really consider Hawaii a permanent home that will benefit our rural communities, all of our state's residents, really, for decades to come.
Yes, and this really is a wonderful gift. I mean, my gosh, you know, we often hear of how expensive a medical school is, and whatever we can do to give our young people a leg up and to be able to then nurture future physicians.
That's right. And we are really intentionally targeting those critical high need practices where we have such a shortage, and it's been difficult to get people to stay in Hawaii because of the cost of living. The cost of education has become exorbitant. And that's one of the things that we found we were really unable to address effectively, in part because all of the healthcare programs that lead to licensure. And for HPU, that includes physician assistant, it includes doctor of physical therapy, occupational therapy, our nursing students, of course. All of these high need areas are governed by specialized accreditation rules that stipulate how education is to be delivered. And as you would imagine, patient safety comes first and foremost, and therefore the requirements to staff those programs have patient safety in mind. But that means we have very few opportunities to really lower tuition in order to make it affordable. This, however, this opportunity with the grant will in fact give our students the opportunity to attend a fairly comparatively expensive program, but without the same loan burden that previously would have been incurred.
And the fact that it's $10 million, I mean, that amount really can be impactful.
Absolutely. We're still waiting for the specific guidelines coming from the state of Hawaii, which will be the primary recipient of the federal funds, and they in turn will disperse. And we're not the only institution to receive some of these grant funds. I know that University of Hawaii Medical School, JAPSM, is going to be a recipient as well. But once we have those parameters in mind, we can then calculate how many students will benefit from this opportunity. But our initial estimates are in the dozens per year. So potentially 30 to 40 students each year for the next 5 years will have the opportunity to achieve their educational dreams without the loan burden that currently is required.
Well, this is, you know, already mid-February, but how soon could we see this helping students? Could we get it in place by the fall?
Yes, absolutely. We are expecting the final specifications to come in any day, and we will receive funds, we're told, in April, which will be the perfect timing to impact the fall recruitment cycle. Our fall programs start in August, and typically students will start to make their decisions about whether they will be able to afford to go to school, and if so, which school they would like to attend. We can get in front of the local applicants and offer this opportunity, this very rare opportunity, and hope to then incentivize them to consider us and other Hawaii schools to start their program in August. So really a perfect timing. We have plenty of time to roll this out to applicants or future applicants. And once established, we think this will become a highly desirable opportunity for other local students to take advantage of.
You know, and I recently recall reading something that outlined, you know, where the shortages were island by island, and it was really startling,
yes.
Particularly in the smaller counties where the need is so great, you know, because you often have people having to fly to Honolulu for care.
Exactly. Yes. And that was something we certainly looked at specifically. So in the rural healthcare transformation grant that the state received, there were funds allocated for assistance with that medical transport need, because we know how burdensome that can be on our state's neighboring island residents, especially when there are particular specialties that can only be found really in Honolulu. And so that factored into the grant, the scholarship grant conversations. We were able to successfully establish that over 90% of the entire state is considered to be a rural serving area, and therefore practitioners theoretically could live and work on Oahu and either travel to neighboring islands as part of their regular patient load or be established on neighboring islands and be able to qualify for this particular loan. So again, we're waiting to see that final specification, but I was encouraged that so much of the state was designated as a rural serving area just for that purpose. It really will help our neighboring island residents get timely care, get the specialty appointments that they need. And because right now there's such a short of practitioners, they can go weeks, sometimes months, before getting in to see some sort of special provider.
You know, I recall the late Dr. Emmett Aluli, right? His community was Molokai, and he was very dedicated to the residents there, and his passing just left a void, and I know they were struggling to try and get other physicians to stay and help patients.
That's
there.
Right.
And so when it's your community, you feel it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's why I was so intent on doing everything we could in order to secure the largest possible award from the federal government, because all of us who live here, who call Hawaii home, are impacted by that shortage. One of the things that I'm particularly excited about is that our physician assistant program is the first from a Hawaii-based institution to be offered. And we have had a challenging time securing clinical rotations for our students in state, in part because the practitioners on ground don't yet have the financial incentives in order to secure our clinical placements for our students. And this will help the financial piece to work out for those students and also the practitioners. And we do have rotations on Molokai for that very reason, because there's such a shortage. Physician assistants are broadly trained. They support the MD staff on site, and they can often fill a critical void when there's a shortage or a vacancy in those MD positions. So we're excited that we now have the second cohort ever in the state of Hawaii. So we're excited that they just started, and pretty soon we'll be able to produce graduates who will go on and live and support and work in those communities very effectively. So that is another program we think will really benefit from this grant and certainly serve a high need on our neighboring island populations.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I know there was a bit of controversy about what fields were considered professional, nursing, and I don't know, was a physician's assistant, was that on the list too?
It was not considered professional. In fact, that was the impetus for moving away from what had previously been working, which is the student loan forgiveness aspect of that the state had done successfully for the last 3 years, and move into a scholarshiping type of arrangement, because I kept reminding everyone that most of our clinicians, the educational programs that produce clinicians, for some reason are considered to be non-professional, even though you cannot work with patients if you don't have a certification and license or coming from a specialized accredited program. Yet the definition that the federal government has apparently decided to go with, although as I understand it, there's still a final process yet to be concluded, but nursing, physician assistant, occupational therapy, physical therapy, social work, psychology was all considered to be non-professional. MD programs, dental programs, we think maybe some of the clinical psychology might be included, but because of that, it's a very small list of medical categories. We recognized that some students will not be able to secure private loan funding in order to even start their education, much less complete it. Because here's the challenge that students are likely to face. If they have to take on $30,000 or $40,000 of private loan debt, that loan is going to be credit score dependent and or require a cosigner in order to qualify. And I know, just given the demographics at HPU, so many of our students are first in their families to go to college. They do not have generational wealth that supports that type of loan securement. And the families may already be leveraged with high housing costs, with mortgages that are priced well above what the national average is. It is going to devastate our community if we don't get ahead of that. I'm hoping that Congress will put some pressure on the federal regulators who are still making that determination to broaden that, particularly for healthcare professions. But if it sticks, we have to get ahead of that with scholarships and grants. Otherwise, we won't see local kids, for the most part, being able to go into these programs simply because they can't afford it.
Yeah, I mean, that one is definitely a head scratcher. It's like, what are we trying to do here? We're shooting ourselves
exactly.
in the foot.
No, you're devastating the pipeline for the very need that you have expressed desire to support. I just don't understand it. It's a cognitive dissonance for sure.
So if anybody out there listening knows of somebody that is interested in these healthcare areas, they just need to stay tuned, because details about how they apply for these programs will be available soon then.
It will be coming soon, but right now information is on our website at www.hpu.edu. And if they send a message, we'll be sure to get back in touch with them just as soon as we have those details available, and that should be coming soon.
That was Hawaii Pacific University's Jennifer Walsh. We spoke with her this week about the future of healthcare workers in Hawaii. And a note, HPU is an HPR underwriter.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of commitment to supporting island businesses, sourcing local products from beef and eggs to papaya and noodles.
Well, I just want to do one more close-up.
Hello, folks. I'm Roger County on After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's new weeknight, late-night music space, where each night brings a different host, genre, and point of view after dark. Every Wednesday, I host jazz and funk sessions, exploring jazz, new jazz, and funk from the roots to the global stage. Music to soundtrack your life, After Hours, Wednesdays from 10 p.m. to midnight on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NareitHawaii.com.
Starting this month, families seeking to enroll their keiki in a Hawaiian immersion program must apply under a new process. It's meant to streamline a popular system and provide the Department of Education with information on where the demand is coming from. Officials say the portal has already received nearly 300 applications since it opened 2 weeks ago. Office of Hawaiian Education Director Kawi Sang sat down with HPR's Kevin Allen to talk about the new Kaipuni process and the general state of Hawaiian immersion education.
For many years, the department has struggled to be able to provide enough seats to meet the demand for families. There are all kinds of reasons for when, why, and how this demand shows up. Mm-hmm. It could be that in existing schools, there just aren't enough seats. It could be that there are families looking to make sure that there's access to Kaipuni education closer to home. And then there are also inquiries that come into the Department of Education from families who may never have an opportunity to enroll in a Hawaiian language immersion school because they're residing outside of Hawaii. And so the department understands that there is a lot of excitement around wanting to make sure that families have access to Hawaiian language immersion education in our public education system. And so part of sort of this shift has really been to start to centralize, if you will, the system with which access is provided so that we can get closer to ensuring that every student that resides in Hawaii, that calls Hawaii their home, that desires Kaipuni education will be able to have access to it.
I see.
And so previous to the Kaipuni priority placement request process, the directions around enrollment and access has really been left up to the individual school sites. And the way in which individual school sites take their enrollment in kind of differ. And so what this process is trying to do is it isn't so much trying to centralize enrollment, more than centralize a way in which we can start to see what demand looks like, perhaps plan better for demand, have some conversations because we can start to see where there's a high number of requests for which locations, and maybe be a little bit more strategic in the way we place resources to be able to meet those kinds of requests. And so in its initial phase of it, what the Office of Hawaiian Education is responsible to do is to provide a process so that people can say, I want to access Kaipuni education for my child, and the options that I would like to have my child enroll in terms of the location, the site where I want to enroll my child in, looks like this. And so if we can collect all of that information, we can start to see, like, this school is going to have a lot of requests for enrollment. If they don't have enough staff, might we be able to plan for placing the resources that are necessary so that we can meet all of those requests? And if not, what do we do about that? I think one of the biggest issues around resourcing demand is tied to having qualified Hawaiian language teachers. I think the department still struggles with trying to figure out how to better ensure the governance structure within our system allows us to plan strategically for other things like transportation to sites, like providing enough school facilities to be able to grow a program. That's besides just making sure that we can get a teacher in a seat. I think that's the number one priority and probably the hugest barrier right now for the system.
Have you guys noticed, I guess, already any specific areas where you are seeing a lot of attention?
Yeah, so the process opened on, was it February 2nd? Mm-hmm. It was a Monday. So the folks could start submitting their request for placement on February 2nd. Since It's opening, so it's almost 2 weeks now. We've already received almost 300 placement requests.
Wow.
What we usually see annually is for access into our kindergarten grade level specifically, or Papamala'o, we usually see requests ranging anywhere from 380 to 450 families wanting to place their students into a Kaipunese Papamala'o classroom at the beginning of the school year. And so taking a look at the placement requests that have already come in, two-thirds of those requests are already at Papamala'o, or a little more than two-thirds of those requests are the Papamala'o requests. So I think it is actually giving us a good sort of 30,000-foot level perspective on where the demand will show up. And we're seeing those hotspots really coming from families that want access closer to the Leeward and Central District.
I see. And this is also a really great place to possibly clear up any misconceptions people might have about, you know, the enrollment process. Does my child need to be part Native Hawaiian? Do they have to enroll at the K level, at the kindergarten level, and go all the way up? Or can they enroll in the third grade?
Yeah. You know, I think it's sort of the more recent history. Folks have been hesitant to investigate whether or not this is an opportunity that their families might want to provide for their own children because of not being Hawaiian and making the assumption that you can only go to this school because it's a charter school, or you can only go to this school because it's for Hawaiians. And that's not the case. Because it's operated by the public education system, the same access is provided regardless of your ethnicity. But I think more recently, there's been a lot of work around debunking that myth. In the data, the enrollment data, we see a lot of Native Hawaiian families enrolling their children in Kaiapuni schools, but we also see a slight increase in non-Native Hawaiian students, students that do not have Hawaiian descent. And I think that's an exciting thing. A friend of mine, I was listening to him on a podcast that he was in, and he was talking about the idea that everybody in Hawaii who calls Hawaii their home should be able to olalo Hawaii. And so I think it supports that same idea that the public education system is the institution that provides free access to public education for all of Hawaii's keiki, and that the way that in which we do that is either through the English medium or the Hawaiian medium. And so people shouldn't feel hesitant if this is something that they would like to see happen for their own children.
And we kind of touched on how, you know, Hawaiian immersion schools really have seen a lot of interest in the past 10 years. It's seen a 67% increase in enrollment. With this new enrollment process, how do you see it maybe helping to keep the program running smoothly?
So I can back up a little bit before I address that part of it. A couple of years ago, the Board of Education did this process where they were doing a new strategic plan from the board level. And then after that, the Department of Education started its work on figuring out how we're going to start to implement those strategic priorities that have been established by the Board of Education. One of those strategic priorities was to actually figure out how to do better by Kaiapuni students, Kaiapuni families, and the schools that serve these keiki. And so the really exciting thing about that and change is that previous to that happening, the ways in which the department was supporting that community, the Kaiapuni community, was probably limited within the Kaiapuni community process. And I think putting this sort of on the scorecard for the department and for the superintendent to be able to say, no, we're going to do something different so that we can ensure that when we say all kids, we mean all kids, really meant that we have to do some significant changes to the system. One of the desired outcomes and action items in our bigger strategic plan was to actually start to think more strategically about Kaiapuni education. And this Kaiapuni priority placement request process really is just the first step in trying to make sure that we can plan short-term and long-term for the kids that are in our classes now, in our schools now, and for making sure that we have better conditions in the long run. And my hope is that over time, we're going to start to be able to improve the conditions with which the Department of Education takes its responsibility and embraces its responsibility to make sure that when we say all kids, we mean all kids. And even in acknowledgement of its kuleana, to ensure that as a state with two official languages, that we are able to embrace that responsibility as well. And so making sure that it becomes less of a blind spot for the department.
Right. And speaking to those blind spots, I guess, you know, and for the external, for parents who are interested? What are really some things that you just want them to know going into this this process?
Yeah. So I think it is important for families to know that if they are just even considering Kaiapuni education for their children, that they should submit a placement request now. The deadline for placement requests is March 13th. And after March 13th, the Office of Hawaiian Education will start its own process to be able to make our placements, make sure we have appropriate resources in place to be able to meet to the best of our ability the desires of our families to be able to enroll their students in the location that they have noted, and then to start to communicate that out to families. And so enrollment into a Kaiapuni school after March 13th will sort of be in a delay so that we can complete that process and honor those ohana that had taken the step to submit a placement request. And then schools will be given back the authority to enroll any new applications after June 1st. And so if you are even considering and would like a placement, it will be the responsibility of the Office of Hawaiian Education to our best of our ability to be able to place everybody that submits a request. And so I would encourage families to participate, get their requests in before March 13th. The other thing that I think is important to say here is that the decision to enroll your child into a Kaiapuni school should not be taken lightly. I've heard previously, you know, comments around, oh my gosh, it's so cute. It's such a cute thing to be able to see the kids speaking and dancing and singing in Hawaiian. Kaiapuni education is a much fuller, much more richer experience, but it is also a long-term commitment. The Kaiapuni education experience, it isn't just a K-12 experience. It should start before kids come into a school, into our schools. And so schools like the Punanaleo preschools are really, really important to have in our communities. For those that are just kind of like, is this something for me? It's definitely something to really take to heart and consider. It shouldn't be a barrier, though, if there is a desire to restore Ulalo Hawaii in the home.
And that was Kawe Sang, Director of the Office of Hawaiian Education, talking with the Conversation's Kevin Allen about a new placement process. The Kaiapuni application portal is open now and will close on March 13th. We continue this thread of Hawaiian Language Month in today's show. HBR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel joins us now live with a story about a Hawaiian language immersion classroom on Molokai. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so tell us about this class you visited.
Yeah, so I visited the sixth grade class at Kula Kaiapuni o Kualapu'u, so Papa E'ono, and they are part of Kualapu'u Public Conversion Charter Schools Immersion Program, which is Molokai's only immersion elementary program. And Kumu Lokelani Han of the sixth grade, it was just so cool to be able to talk with her, talk with the class, see language alive and well in the classroom. They're practicing culture daily. They're learning topics that are relevant today. And really, you know, inspiring to hear their class. So the students are, you know, of course, this is their daily lives, right? At school, they're learning and speaking Olelo Hawaii. But there are a few ways that they are particularly observing Mahino Olelo Hawaii. They have a speech competition coming up next week. So they were practicing an oli for that they'll be doing individually. And then they also had an annual fundraiser called Hana Keaka, which helps to support the immersion programs at Kualapu'u School. And so I was able to go to that as well. It was beautiful to see this program that the students had put together. So I asked the Papa E'ono students, the Haumana, to share an olelo noia, which is a Hawaiian proverb, or a phrase in Hawaiian, and what it means to them to share with us. So here's what a few students said.
Ma ola ona yao is aohe pu'uki eke e hoa o e pi'i. Every time when I do work, I don't give attitude. Because when I have a kule on it to do, I always gotta do it so I can get more better at doing my work.
Aloha ke kahi I ke kahi. No ka mea pono kako e aloha aku a aloha mai. We need to love and give love to receive love.
Mai mako'u I ka hana mako'u I ka moloa. It means don't be scared of the work, be scared of being lazy. That appeals to me because I never give up. I work hard on my homework, I work hard on anything I put my mind to. I went into Hawaii because my mom told me my dad and her never had the chance, so they gave me the chance because it's an opportunity for me. They didn't have an opportunity to ulele Hawaii, so I had the chance, so I went. And it is really koikoi because we don't have that much Hawaiians anymore.
Oh, so interesting. I love that one, though. Every time I do work, right? I don't be scared of the work. Be scared of being lazy.
Yeah, so it was so interesting to hear the students. You know, ʻōlelo no iao are, you know, phrases that we often hear in Hawaii, but hearing how they incorporate it into their daily lives was really interesting, and hearing their take on it, it was really fun talking to them. So their teacher, Loke Lani, has been teaching for over 20 years. She graduated high school in 1983, and when she was growing up, there were no Kaiapuni programs. So I asked her if she heard ʻōlelo Hawaii at all when she was young, and here's what she said.
My ʻōlelo was very sporadic. I remember my parents talking with friends, mako ʻōlelo Hawaii, but we knew that they were talking stink, I guess. They were gossiping about somebody when they spoke ʻōlelo Hawaii. That was my recollection. Like, I could hear them talking. They sang, you know, Hawaiian music. They loved Hawaiian music. But every time I remember them speaking Hawaiian, it was because they were trying to hide something from us. And so that was the extent of my knowledge about Hawaiian language. I didn't fully embrace ʻōlelo Hawaii until I went to high school and I started dancing hula. And from that, it started opening up a world of like literature and mele and hula and olean. And that was what grabbed me, was being able to look at these texts from our kupuna and understand what they were talking about.
Yeah, that's interesting. She thought they were gossiping and trying to hide it from them.
Yeah, it's just interesting, you know, going from this language being almost extinct to, you know, the generation sort of in between of how they use the language. And now that it's coming back and hearing, you know, so many haumana as you walk down the hallway in the school, just talking with each other in Hawaiian, learning in Hawaiian. It's, you know, it's a really inspiring trend and, you know, not trendy, but, you know, just an embracing of the culture and really seeing that in practice. The statewide immersion preschool program, Punana Leo, as we just heard about, began in 1983. And the Hawaiian language immersion program was first implemented by the Department of Education in 1987. And Kuala Pu'u Public Conversion Charter School runs, as I said, the island's elementary level immersion program that began in 1993. And so there's, you know, Punana Leo on Molokai as well as middle school and high school programs that all work together to help these haumana, you know, grow up in the language and really become carriers of it moving forward. So I asked Kumu Loke Lani about the challenges of teaching the language. And she talked about, you know, reading materials that are much more available now, which is great. But she did talk about, unlike English language programs in the DOE, they don't have a standardized curriculum for Hawaiian. And so, you know, testing is also a challenge. She talked about the variations in the language from island to island, which I found really fascinating. Here she talks about that.
It really does lay on the shoulders of each program to find material, to create their own lessons, to develop their own curriculum. And that's part of the fun. But it also is part of the challenge because, especially with testing, you're trying to use a broad range of language that everyone may be familiar with. And sometimes on different islands, they use a different word for the same thing. Like we call the fern shoot pohole. Some other people have a different word for it. Our directionals are different. East, most islands, Hikina, Molokai is Ka'elelani. Yeah. So those things. It's a challenge to have to figure out what is the generally accepted term for most of the state, and then to be true to our island language, but also to include that generalized term so that our kids, once they do see a test, they're not totally like confused. What does that word mean, Kumu? I've never seen that word before.
That is interesting. You would think that they would have a standard curriculum.
Yeah, so, you know, like you said, it's a lot on the teachers of the individual programs to guide what their classrooms are learning. She's also been on the committee that develops the standardized testing for Hawaiian language, and she said they're constantly reviewing and updating those tests, you know, to reflect that language, as she said. So there's also lots of ways to learn the language, online classes, college classes, there's community groups at the school. So really exciting to see the language carrying forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can check out our coverage of Hawaiian Language Month by heading to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help local residents and businesses prepare for natural disasters and emergencies. Learn more at hawaiigas.com/safety.
Remember when you'd see a bill signing at the White House with lawmakers from both parties celebrating an achievement? Don't look now, but maybe we're getting close to that. A bipartisan bill to make housing more affordable in our country breezed through the House. I'm David Green. There is still lots of work to do on this legislation, but this moment is starting to feel real. We'll talk about it on the next Left, Right, and Center.
Beginning this evening at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
One of the first restaurants to rebuild in Lahaina after being destroyed in the 2023 fires was a popular Italian joint by the name of Sale Pepe. And the head chef was recently recognized as a James Beard Award semifinalist. And if that wasn't reason enough to speak to Chef Michele DeBari and owner-operator Kiana DeBari, we learned that the two had a love story perfect for Valentine's Day. The DeBaris had been together for 20 years, married for 15. They met in New York, where Michele ran 10 restaurants. And Kiana managed musical talent, including a tribe called Quest and Q-Tip. The conversation's Maddie Bender asked the DeBaris about their love story. Kiana starts us off.
Oh my God, it's a good one.
Yeah, from the start of the time.
We tell it differently.
She came one day in a restaurant and she was all over me.
Not true.
Staring at me like crazy. I was like, oh my goodness.
No.
What am I going to do? Talk to my team. I was like, look at this girl looking at me like crazy.
No.
No, I'm joking. This is a joke that I told everybody.
He tells everybody that joke.
You know, it's the opposite.
But we met in a restaurant. That part is true.
Yeah.
My sister's boyfriend worked for him at his restaurant, Sapore.
Sapore, yeah.
In the West Village. I walked in with my sister and Michele's at the door and he's like, ciao, Bella. And I'm like, oh my gosh, who is this guy? So we have vibes immediately, but we were both in relationships at the time and never said a word to each other. For 5 years, we would just say, ciao, hello, ciao, goodbye. Never said a word. And then one day my sister came home and said, Michele moved to DR. And I said, what? As if he needed to give me permission. I was like so upset. It's like, you didn't ask me permission first. But I didn't know him. I remember feeling really disappointed. So some time goes by, maybe a year or two.
1 year.
And then my sister says, let's try this new restaurant in Park Slope, where we're from. I want to bring you to this restaurant. Like, I just broken up with my boyfriend like 6 months prior. I was like, oh, I don't feel like going out, but I'll come out. And I meet my sister in Park Slope, and we walk into this restaurant, and who's at the front door but Michele De Bari. And once again, he's like, ciao, Bella. And on this time, we were both free. Yeah. And what happened?
Yeah, I asked him for take a walk to go get some bread.
Yeah, he asked me to take a walk to the bakery.
Wow, that's like a rom-com.
It's ridiculous.
And then, of course, you opened your restaurant. What was your philosophy with opening Sale Pepe? It really does stand out in Lahaina. Like, you're not serving macadamia-crusted mahi-mahi, right?
You know, like I said, we were supposed to stay 1 year. I was supposed to find a job. And that's what we were supposed to roll. And then me, being a crazy New Yorker, you know, every place for rent, even if I was looking for a figure out, you know.
He calls them for fun.
You know, I was just calling.
He does.
You know, I got some really good job offer anyway. But anyway, so making call on some place for rent. I saw this place, which is Sale Pepe, why I was waiting to start the job. And I made a crazy offer and they took it. They say, you know, come to our, by the way, I'm talking about the Weinberg Foundation, head in Jeanette. Why don't come to Oahu and we would like to meet you and we can talk about your project, what you're thinking. And I'm going to, you know, we're going to Oahu. I'm going to this meeting. I don't know. I have flip-flop, I have short, you know. And I'm going to this office with this big table. It's like 20 people sit down. Nobody's talking. And there is this big guy on the back, which is the boss, the CEO of the company. It was just crazy. It was just so insane. This story is insane. So I'm there like, wow, this is serious. I just say to them, you know, that's what we want to do. We want to do like an authentic Italian restaurant, you know, simple cuisine. And just like I'm saying to you right now. And they were.
But like, that's another love story. Like the Sale Pepe story is another love story in that we really wanted to show people some true food with integrity. We wanted it to be really accessible so that everybody could enjoy it. We really had locals in our mind right off the top and wanted it to be approachable. And we had this idea of like a Cheers vibe where people could just come and be themselves. The food was elevated. And that's another love story, our obsession with Maui's produce and Italian food. Those are two different deep love stories. But we wanted to bring something really authentic and true and with a strong voice to Lahaina in a way that we hadn't seen before. And people thought we were crazy because Longies was across the road and we didn't know anybody.
Ah, people would say, you guys wasting your time. Restaurant closed down after no time.
Yeah.
Like the minute we landed at the hotel at the Hyatt, like literally the guy with the bellman was like, you want to open a restaurant here? You guys are crazy.
So
that's how we were like, oh shoot, what are we doing?
But as a visitor, after coming for so many years, I knew there was a void and a niche for an alternative, and we weren't afraid of being that. Like, we knew that there was an abundance of this Pacific Rim macadamia nut crusted poke driven, which we love, we're obsessed with. But like, after visiting over the years, we had this hankering for some
true
food with some deep roots in his culture. So that's why we decided to go forward with Sale Pepe.
And you did carve out that space for yourself. I love the comparison you made to like a Cheers type place where visitors and locals alike could enjoy the cuisine. Skipping ahead in the timeline to the 2023 wildfires, which destroyed your restaurant. I think a lot of people, I mean, not just in the restaurant business, but overall, look at that moment, that decision to pick up the pieces and rebuild as a real fork in the road that a lot of people in Maui and all over the country after disasters have to think about. And Kiana, I think I read somewhere that for you, it was like a post 9/11 moment. Talk a little bit more about your decision-making, what you decided, why you decided to rebuild.
I did think about 9/11, and I thought about how we came back from that. as a city and as a country, and how when I go back home, downtown is where I go. It is now the most desirable destination. What once was a disaster area is the most desired place for me to be when I do go back home. And I thought about how the city and state and the nation supported the regrowth in that area. And I thought about how the community in that area really came together to make sure that there was a healing. And so I assumed that the same thing could happen here, or even better, given how community-centered we are as a culture here on Maui and in Lahaina. And I just never imagined that, like, Lahaina would just die softly on the vine. I just never thought it would not be. And who better than the people who are in love with this place and invested in this place to show up and choose it and to help our community navigate its way back to whatever the new normal is going to be, because we're not there yet. But it was shocking. It was painful.
Still.
It is still really hard. And we left for stretches of time. Our daughter's school survived up in West Maui. But whenever she had a break, we would leave for stretches of time and think about Italy. Think about New York as a possibility. Maybe it was San Francisco. But just the idea of beginning again and leaving this behind did not feel right to us. We had to do what was right. And we love our town. We love our home. We love our employees. We love our local customers. We love our annual visit. We have so much relationship.
Our community.
We have so much relationship that we just couldn't imagine walking away from the love of so many people. So it was hard. It's still hard, but you can speak more to our decision.
You should definitely take a big chance.
Yeah. It's still scary.
We are in the beginning and the middle, actually, yeah.
We're in the middle of the beginning.
Yeah.
That's what he said. Yeah, we're in the middle of the beginning.
Definitely take a big risk, you know. They have to take a lot of debt to do this, but we, you know, we thought it was the right thing to do.
That was the duo behind West Maui's Sale Pepe restaurant, Michele and Kiana DeBari. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. Head to our website after the show to hear their advice for other couples. And happy Valentine's Day. You know, before we go, we wanted to check in with Hawaii's government, a reporter, Ashley Mazuo. She's been tracking a news conference at the State Attorney's General office this morning and joins us live. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I imagine that this was basically announced to deal with all the questions that have been raised about a potential conflict of interest.
Yes, exactly. You know, Special Investigation and Prosecutive Division is handling the case within the Attorney General's department, and they say that they've already issued subpoenas and conducted interviews. She couldn't really share any actual timeline about where they are in the investigation other than that. And she says that, you know, although that, you know, they are very aware that the, you know, August primaries are not too far away, but nobody's putting political pressure on them to, you know, like wrap up their investigation into this by then. But they are aware of it, and so they're trying to work as quickly as possible. And they say that, you know, the ultimate investigation is not far away. But she really made an effort to talk about the Special Investigation and Prosecutive Division and about how that is, you know, taking the case. And she says that's why there is no conflict of interest. Let's take a listen.
There is no conflict because of my prosecutorial independence. I really want people to understand that. I can't be influenced. But having said that, our supervising deputy for that branch is David Van Acker. He is an incredibly talented and capable prosecutor. He and his team, I believe he's got another prosecutor and two investigators and analysts working on this almost day and night because they understand the importance. I am not going to substitute my judgment for their recommendations. They will come and they will make a recommendation to me, and I will follow that recommendation. trust in their work and their integrity. So any decision I make will be based on their recommendation.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that we kind of jumped right into it, but, you know, of course, this is about the $35,000 that an influential lawmaker allegedly took back in 2022 related to the federal bribery case of, you know, former House Representative Ty Cohen and Senator Kalani English. And so the state attorney general has been investigating this, and there have been calls for her to appoint some type of special prosecutor. But she says that's actually not possible. The state doesn't have the law to do that. There is this thing called the special deputy attorney general that she could, bring on, but she says that person would still be accountable to her, so that wouldn't necessarily provide what the calls are for her to appoint a special prosecutor. She hasn't shared any information with Governor Green about the investigation, other than what's already been shared with reporters and the public at large. And she says she will not share any information with him. She's committing to giving an update on the case every 2 weeks. And I think one of the things that has been brought up too is this idea about the line of succession for, you know, the lieutenant governor. If the lieutenant governor is no longer in that position, the line of succession is Senate president, then speaker, and then the attorney general. And she says that if it did come to that situation, she would not accept the position. And so she made that very clear during the press conference today.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting to see, you know, just trying to make that line between her office and the governor's office, and trying to keep the integrity of the investigation. Like I said, though, there have been many calls for her to, declared that there could be a possible conflict and turn it over to someone else. If it's, you know, if they're investigating somebody on the executive team.
Exactly. And I think, too, one of the points that she did make is that although she, you know, is appointed by the governor and then confirmed by the Senate, that the governor cannot remove her from her position. The only way that that can happen is by a majority vote by the Senate. And so that she's saying that that provides another layer of cover for there being like a wall between her and the executive branch.
Yeah, all very interesting. But yeah, all kinds of developments. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Ashley Mizuo. You can head to HawaiiPublicRadio.org to see more of our coverage on this issue. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we have special programming in place for President's Day. We do a deep dive into Pacific Ahi. Call our talkback line, leave us some feedback, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital Team. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Tuesday. Pick up the conversation.